right, this is Pure Decking for September the 6th, 1915. This is a show about stuff that interests me. I'm Morps. Tonight we have BSV, Suave, and Hugo, who's back after a long absence. So, what's everybody drinking tonight?
Tequila and muffin.
Not tequila and a muffin, yeah. I've got Johnny Walker, and I've actually drank most of it already. So we know Suave's drinking tequila and eating a muffin, which I don't know how that works. What's everybody else drinking?
Sadly, nothing.
Nothing.
I'm boring tonight. I'm drinking lemon mint tea. It needs tequila. That's what it needs.
Very nice. So, anyways, just a little bit of station. Instead of station news or feedback, I thought it'd be fun to do a little discussion about the station. This is not Pure Decking. This is G15, the station, Galaxy 15 Radio. It's kind of, where's everybody thinking we ought to go with the station? I mean, just to throw it out there, personally, I mean, I don't want to stop doing Pure Decking or anything or any of the other shows, but I kind of want to focus on the music side of things. I'd like to get some DJs, some keep the music up to date. Of course, no money involved because I don't actually have any money. I don't know about you guys, but I all my money goes into running the damn station. I can't actually buy content, so
the station doesn't make money. It takes money.
I did the math, dude. Running the station cost me about $65 a month.
Ugh.
That's not bad, but that's not that's not great either. And
really, when you think about it, you're running a radio station for $65 a month.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Well, that and I probably spent. If you average out the amount of gear I've bought, I've probably spent maybe $1,000 in gear over the past, year and a half?
But you probably didn't require all that gear to actually do what we're doing, did you? It just makes it better.
No. I've gotten to the point, a couple of times I figured out ways to do it without a lot of this gear, but the gear is certainly seems to be the best way to go. Like I'd like to think all the audio quality has improved over time. I'm not sure
if you're anything like me. The show and the station is just an excuse to buy gear.
Oh.
Toasty!
Yeah, I think you might be right, actually. I'm just looking at the array of MIDI controllers and mixers and the massive amount of audio cable over there on the rack, and it's like, yeah, he might be right. So, I don't know. What are you guys thinking about direction for the station, if any?
I like the idea of getting more music oriented to an extent. It's definitely a good idea, and there's a lot of great like cyberpunk type artists out there, but I do like the idea of just kind of keeping the cyberpunk theme, and like you said, like keep doing Pure Decking and anything else like that. But I think it's a
good
idea.
It would be nice to have a DJ on or something now and again whenever there's not a show going on.
Well, I know for a fact that Patient Zero had a friend of his who was interested in DJing. Now, I haven't heard back from him in a while, but we've actually got the station to the point where we can have live DJs, and it's not going to require anything hokey with VNC or anything like that. We can just essentially give them a time slot and a port to throw an Icecast stream at, and it'll just take over the stream live. That's actually how we do the live shows now, by the way, is we don't pause the stream and then take over the machine that's actually handling things. We have a port we throw an Icecast stream at, and it takes over the station, which is really cool. So, we're totally set up. We could have, live DJs, and all I have to do is set up a password for them, essentially. And they can just take over the stream and DJ. Now, the one thing is we have to make sure they understand that, no copyrighted music, no music we have to have a license to play or anything like that. But because no money's involved. It's more for, the fun of it and self-promotion. And, if you are an aspiring, if you're making music and you're wanting to get it out there and it's, not terrible, let us know. we can get it out there. So anyways, I just thought I'd throw that out there and see what you guys were thinking. I saw Aryu on tonight. I was kind of hoping to get him in for that discussion, but he's not wanting to do a show tonight, and I don't blame him. So, anyways, moving on. So to the regular discussion section for Pure Decking, which I am horrible at transitions tonight. I either need more or less alcohol, and I'm not sure which.
So, more is always better.
Well, more is the direction we're going. So, how much actually can you trust your systems, your hardware, your phone, your operating system? I mean, with Anonymous did the big Apple UUIDs release, and the FBI's saying, "Oh, it didn't come from us," and Anonymous is saying it did, and it's back and forth and back and forth. Of course, it's nothing new that iPhones are being monitored, essentially. Android phones had the built-in keylogger, the Carrier IQ, that came out last year. And, of course, it gets down to even shit like keyboards with a Tensi installed in them. And I have made one, and it's great fun loaning it out to people. Because it's like, oh, look, a shell. And I'm going to talk about that when we get to Digital Dojo. So it just kind of seems like everybody is trying to spy on the user these days. Down to the point of it's built into the systems.
I'd say it's nothing new. The only difference is technology's evolved. I'd say phones and mobile devices are probably the biggest at risk, which keep your private data off there if possible. Computers, like the actual physical computers that sit on your desk, are quite a bit better because other than operating systems, stuff like that, stuff like Teensy, unless they're stupid enough to borrow a keyboard from you, you have to get physical access to the machine, right? So... it's still fairly reliable. But yeah, I'd say phones are the ones I'm most worried about, especially since the GPS track you now.
Well, if you think about it, Apple has been so gung-ho on the mobile platform with some of this tracking. You know, they're trying to start implementing a lot of it on the desktop with the sandboxing and the app store on the desktop. And they're even making the latest versions of OS X look like the mobile within, the take over the screen menus to launch stuff, and I'm sure Windows 8 is trying to do the same thing. So how long before you have to run Linux if you're doing anything even remotely subversive?
I do anyway. It's called virtual machines.
There you go. It's a very fair point.
Although the only difference is in the future it's going to switch around so that like Linux is my main, and then I run all the crapware in the virtual machines.
Well, I know a couple of people who live that way as is, and I've been exploring it to see if I could switch my main rig over to Linux, and it's so close it hurts. It's just there's a couple of things that just don't fly, VST plugins and stuff like that. So I mean it's really close, and I've got some hardware that won't work in Linux either, which is frustrating, but it's getting close. So I mean I'm thinking the next year or so I might be able to completely switch almost everything over. I mean, for the most part, the station can run entirely open source software. The broadcast box already does. The relay box I'm looking at, there's no reason it couldn't. It just doesn't right now because the machine I'm using had Windows installed when I started, so I just ran with what was on it. There's no reason it can't. The mixing I'm doing now for the relay box is all hardware, so there's no reason it wouldn't work. But I don't know. I mean, is it really getting to the point that if you didn't solder the machine yourself, you can't trust it?
Never trust anything.
Yeah, well, other than phones and stuff like that, at the moment, anyway. A machine, the hardware is only controlled by the software, right? So as long as you have control of the software still, you're still pretty much in the clear.
Well, Windows 8, they're talking about bringing in that trusted bootloader to where it won't even boot an operating system unless it's approved by, I guess in this case, Microsoft.
Yeah, but how long till that's hacked? I'm going to give it like 2 or 3 days.
Well, I mean, turn it off, but I mean...
Not just the software or anything either. Like, weren't they talking about like routers and stuff like that had... built-in like spyware from China and stuff like that.
A lot of the big router makers, Juniper and Cisco especially, they're manufactured overseas. So there was a big scare a couple of months ago that all these Cisco systems had backdoors in them from the Chinese government. Now they pretty much came out and said no, that's not happening. This isn't happening. But
That's just what they want you to think.
Well, that's the truth, isn't it? I mean, how are you going to know unless you know exactly how to hit these things? Because, I mean, unless you port scan the box, and even then, that's not reliable because they might do something like a port knock to activate the back door, or even worse, if it's not coming from a certain, you know, range, would it respond? So, mm-hmm. I mean, the testing for these things would have to be pretty elaborate. So, I don't know.
This is why I have a box full of old laptops, because that way I have something to fall back on.
Well, it's true. I mean, I've got the Commodore 64 that I've rigged to get on the internet, and I'm pretty sure that there's nothing running on that. Not because I trust the makers of the Commodore 64, but because I don't think the thing's powerful enough to actually run a keylogger. It's like when the thing's network card has more horsepower than the processor. great story. I was working on the Commodore 64. Actually, this is when I was getting the internet card for it working. I've got a Comet 64 for it, by the way. And I got one of those, hello, your computer has virus. We from Microsoft. And, telemarketing calls trying to get me to run some kind of a rat on my system so they can get in and hack it and then charge me $100 or whatever to fix it. And I didn't have a virtual machine handy, and so I was just kind of being a dick with the guy, and I'm like, yeah, you know how many computers I have in this house? Which one? Oh, the one you're in front of. The one I'm in front of. Oh, yes, definitely. You realize the one I'm in front of is a computer from 1982 and can't even run Windows, let alone any other operating systems. And the guy goes, yes, that's the one. I wish I was making this shit up, but it's like you're telling me a Commodore 64, which is not physically capable of running any version of Windows at all, and I'm not talking about, you know, GEOS. GEOS is not Windows. GEOS is GEOS. And later was adapted into a cell phone operating system. But that's not my point. It's like this thing's running Commodore 64 basic. If there's a keylogger in here, whoever it is deserves to get what I'm keeping on this machine.
Well, they're just following a script. They don't know shit. They don't even speak English very well.
Oh, I know. I know.
I tried to prank one time by claiming I was from Microsoft, and he didn't understand. He's like, oh yes, Microsoft. I'm like, oh, okay. This is not worth my time.
I mean, it's one of those things. I've seriously thought about rigging up a. I haven't gotten one of those calls in a while because I was getting them for a little while and then they quit. I guess because I fucked with them every time. I was seriously considering building a system so that they could remote into it and then have it attack them back. Essentially, once they set up a network connection to it, use their pipe up to just pivot in and start wrecking shit.
Mm-hmm.
But the only problem with that is, one, they quit calling me, so I can't actually do that trick if they don't call me. And, two, the call center probably does legitimate stuff during the day, and it's like at night when they're doing this shit. So it's like, well, I could wreck all this shit, and then I'm probably messing up some legitimate business where their guys at night are just dicks. So I wasn't sure on that one. It's like, well, they kind of deserve it. But on the other hand, so I don't know. Anyways, though, let's go ahead and move on to the stories here. First one's up from BGR. The Federal Communications Commission home broadband speed tests have been such a success that they're now coming to the wireless world. The FCC on Wednesday proposed a new program that would let smartphone users test their wireless connections and upload the results to a government database to develop information on mobile broadband service performance in the United States. The FCC will hold an open meeting on September the 21st to hear an industry and consumer comment on the technical methods of performance testing for mobile broadband service, methodological, I can't speak, too much alcohol, approaches to remotely acquiring and analyzing such data, and other methodological considerations for the testing of mobile broadband performance. So in other words, the FCC is going to start enforcing truth in advertising when it comes to how fast your phone's internet speed is supposed to be.
Yay.
Hey, what a good idea.
Can we kill this whole AT&T 4G thing?
It's not really 4G.
Oh, I know. That's why. Can we kill it? Yeah, like, can we do that now?
So, I mean, I don't know. I normally don't like regulations of any sort when it comes to the internet. I mean, you know, you can have the net neutrality argument.
You could, you, You gotta regulate telling the truth in your advertising.
I'm down for that. I am absolutely down for truth in advertising, because otherwise you have guys, oh yeah, we got 4 billion megabits per second, and poor smucks will believe that shit, and then you know, or when they're all just lying to you. I mean, my only fear with is somebody's going to use this as a gateway to start regulating other stuff, because
everybody knows the slippery slope argument is a pile of crap.
It's not entirely a pile of crap when it comes to things like legal precedent, and I'm okay with this. I think this is good, because I like enforcing the truth on them, or even with the threat of enforcing the truth on them to make them actually, you know, go up to what they're advertising. I kind of shy away from the idea of having them regulate the internet in any way, because you might like what the current group in power is doing. What happens when the next set gets elected and you don't like them in power anymore?
Right. Well, if the regulation only says they have to enforce it so that it's only the truth, I know they're politicians, so they have a way of twisting that. But at least there's a guideline. The truth is still truth.
Yeah, they're just enforcing truth in advertising in this case, so I don't have a problem with that.
Now, if it's bigger regulation powers, that's when you get trouble.
Yeah. All right, so next one up here is from Ars Technica. At 6:08 a.m. on October the 4th, 2009, Trisha Oliver frantically called 911 from her apartment in Cranston, Rhode Island, where her 6-year-old son, Marco Knives, stopped breathing. The fire department took Marco to Hasbro Children's Hospital, where he was found to be in full cardiac arrest. He died 11 hours later. Oh, that sucks. Kid died.
Yeah.
At 6:20 a.m., Sergeant Michael Kite of the Cranston Police Department had arrived at the apartment, where he found Oliver, her boyfriend Michael Pantio, and their 14-month-old daughter, Jaslyn Oliver. Damn, I am sucking at reading the stories tonight. Kite observed a couple of stripped beds and linens on the floor, a trash can with vomit inside, dark brown vomit in a toilet, and crucially, a cell phone on the kitchen counter. Kite picked up the cell phone, and it was at that point in the just released opinion of a Rhode Island state court that the police proceeded to mangle a murder case and violate Pantio's Fourth Amendment rights by viewing text messages without a warrant. Now, this is why we're talking about the story, not because the kid died, although that's sad. Kite viewed a text message on the phone, which was owned by Trisha Oliver, reading, what if I got to take him to the hospital? What do I say? And does marks, I'm trying to read this thing phonetically, and does marks on his neck, OMG. God, that's full on SMS speak there. The message was sent from Oliver to Patio, who was although the sending of the message apparently failed. There were other messages on the phone with profane language and references to punching Marco 3 times, the hardest of which was in the stomach, according to the court records. Pantio was arrested and charged with murder. So in other words, the text messages proved that this guy was beating this kid before he died in the hospital. Or she. Was it he or she? Anyways. It's a long story. Kite claims he picked up the phone because it was beeping and that he thought it might help get in touch with the boy's birth father. But yesterday, Rhode Island Superior Court Associate Justice Judith Savage, nice name, Judith Savage, there's a name, threw out nearly all of the evidence police collected from that point on, including the contents of cell phones, police records, or phone records, and communications provided by Verizon, T-Mobile, and Sprint Nextel, landline phone records, and even Patino's confession of the death of Marco Knives. Savage said almost all the evidence obtained by the police was tainted by the illegal search made by Sergeant Kite or other illegal searches and seizures of cell phones and their contents. So in other words, this guy got off because the judge said the police didn't have the right to go through this guy's cell phone without a warrant. I guess it was the woman's cell phone. Anyways, Pantio is fighting the case on both constitutional grounds and on the facts. He says the injuries to the boy were an accident as a result of horsing around. Savage's decision in the state of Rhode Island versus Michael Patino is a bold and interesting one because the status of text messages in criminal investigations remains unsettled in the U.S. Savage wrote, "This court finds that it is objectively reasonable for people to expect the contents of their electronic text messaging to remain private, especially vis-a-vis law enforcement." Patino had a right to privacy for his text messages, conversations, whether police took them from his phone or Oliver's, and a right to privacy in the apartment because he frequently stayed there, making it one of his residences. Based on the tsunami of illegal evidence collected by the Cranston Police Department, the court grants the defendant suppression motion and excludes all the state's core evidence from being used at trial, including text messages. I'm going to stop the story there because it just keeps going. So essentially, the court threw out this guy's text messages, and because they didn't have, the judge felt that the defendant was right that they didn't have permission to search the cell phone, because apparently the phone was sitting out in plain sight when they called, when they called 911, and he just picked it up and started flipping through text messages.
Yeah, I think you do have a reasonable right to expect privacy on your digital device. With that said, especially in this specific case.
Yeah, it sounds like Scumbag beat the kid to death, right?
Yeah, and then they did not, the thing key is here, they did not take him to a hospital. Even if it was accidental, they didn't take him to a hospital. That is gross negligence, and they should still be going to jail.
So.
Yeah, while it's sad that the kid died, and this it's even sadder that the guy's going to, walk, even though he's clearly probably guilty. I do think the judge made the right call here, because those text messages, I wouldn't call it conclusive evidence, I think. It is really strong evidence, but I wouldn't call it enough to seal the case. And thing is, from that point on, the way police investigations work is they use that evidence that they already have to gather more evidence, like confession. They may have used those text messages to get a confession thing, whether or not the guy was guilty. Probably was, but they used those. And so the fact that they didn't get a warrant and stuff like that, even though the case clearly was the guy was clearly guilty and that this is clear good evidence in the case, because they didn't do proper procedure, you can't just walk in someone's house and look through mail, even if there's a criminal case involved, you have to get a warrant first. If the guy looked through mail, it would have been thrown out immediately. So I think this is the right decision here, because really, the electronic medium should be treated like physical medium. Like, your email should be as private as your mail, and your text messages should be similar.
Well, now, you got to be careful with that, because by saying that your electronic documents or electronic information should be treated the same as physical, you can be compelled to produce a key for a safe, especially if they have a warrant. You cannot be compelled to give a password, because that's testifying against yourself.
Ah, that's true. But, in the case of them searching your stuff, they should at least try to get a warrant first. I mean, in the case of a cell phone, they don't have to worry about them destroying evidence, because they can just pull the records off either person's cell phone, or in some cases, they can probably pull them from the telephone company, too.
Yeah.
So it's not like getting it now is important.
Well, and you know, too, the thing is, so they called 911, right? I mean, maybe I mangled the reading of the story here.
Yeah, but didn't they wait for a long time before doing that?
They called 911 at 6:08 a.m. And so the cops got there about 20 minutes, or no, not even 20 minutes, 12 minutes later. And that's when he got to the apartment. So good response time on the cops. And
but he's probably beating the kid the night before.
Yeah, it doesn't say.
Yeah,
it doesn't say. There's not a timestamp on the text message.
I feel like beating your kid at 6 a.m. isn't as common as beating your kid late at night after you've been drinking a lot.
Yeah. From the context of the article here, and from the knowledge of medics here, this kind of case isn't that uncommon, because they called 911 after the kid stopped breathing. Now, normally in an abuse situation where they actually kill the person, that's usually when they'll do it, because they'll kill them and freak out. Because for some reason, they get in their head through all the beating and stuff like that they're not actually going to kill them. And then when they do, that's when they freak out and call 911.
Okay.
Right.
All right. Well, Yeah, I mean, it sucks that the kid died and this guy beat him to death, and this is what it takes to set the precedent that, no, if you're going to search somebody's electronics, you need a warrant. So,
mm-hmm.
Anyways.
And like, it should be the same as looking through your house. It's like going through your filing cabinet.
Yeah,
that's pretty much what
disagree.
It's like.
I mean, I just harken back to, I remember I was over at Madman's apartment, and this is the apartment he had two apartments ago, and he was watching Law and Order, and they started searching somebody's computer because he bumped the guy intentionally bumped the desk to knock the screensaver off so he could see what the what was on the computer, and started searching through their computer, and that was how they caught the murderer or whatever. And it was just like, really? It's like, I hated that because it just, of course, you know, the person would have gotten off if they hadn't searched the computer or whatever. So I guess it's, you know, programming there, but I just hate that they feel like they can dig through people's stuff on a computer. And I don't really have that much room to talk because in my day job, I kind of do that, but they're on my network. So I have a little bit of justification, but I mean, it's still, you know, it's still one of those things. It's like, oh, look at this. I was trying to catch malware, and this is somebody's IRC chat logs. Yeah.
Yeah, it's different in your case, though, because it's like on your network. I'm guessing like corporate network kind of thing.
Yeah, I'll explain it to you in detail later.
It's like if I'm on the phone network, I can't be expected that's private except for within my corporation kind of thing. So the computer, I kind of feel the same. If I'm on a company computer, I don't expect to be private. I expect my company to know what I'm doing if they really want to know.
Well, I work at a university. I'm not going to specify which one. So we're kind of an ISP to students. So it gets a little bit weird.
But again, you're also not a law enforcement.
Right, that's true.
Pulling evidence.
And, you know, I mean, I'm not intentionally looking through people's shit looking for stuff. I'm trying to stop malware and botnets and shit, right? So it's like,
mm-hmm.
It's like, I really don't care what's in your email. I really don't care what you're saying to people over IRC, and I really wish I hadn't seen it. mean, so anyways, let's move on here to something infinitely more fun. This is from Engadget. North Carolina State University researchers have figured out a way to remotely control a real Madagascar hissing cockroach. They used an off-the-shelf microcontroller to tap into the roach's antenna and abdomen, and then sent commands that fooled the insect into thinking danger was near or that an object was blocking it. That let the scientists wirelessly prod the insect into action and then guide it precisely along a curved path. They were driving the fucking thing. And shows the video. There's a video on the link. If you follow the link, there's an awesome video where they're driving this cockroach around. The addition of a sensor could allow the insect to one day perform tasks like searching for tracked victims in a disaster. I just like that they used a Madagascar hissing cockroach. And did they have a button to make it hiss?
I want to know how long before we see those boots in the mall. You know the ones that sell those like remote control like vehicles and stuff? I want to see how long it takes for them to get a kit on the shelf there for this.
Catch a bug, wire it up, and drive it around the house.
Fun for the whole family.
Imagine how much joy your cat would get out of this.
Imagine someone catching one of those giant Australian spiders and doing this to them.
Oh, God. Oh, God. So we've discovered an entirely new way to make horror movies. Holy shit. But yeah, they were driving a cockroach around. So on one hand, that's pretty badass. On the other hand, there's kind of an ick factor because it is a really big fucking cockroach. Go watch the video. It's cool. Anyways, so that's pretty cyberpunk.
Well, you know, this is great. And, you know, I've actually seen them do stuff like this with beetles and stuff like that before. It's not exactly new.
But they were doing this in the Fifth Element movie. I mean, come on.
Oh, yeah. But it's just so fucking awesome because it's real. And we have electronics that are small enough that you could easily put like a listening device, even a small camera on a cockroach.
It's and the like cock cam. Oh, wait, that came out wrong. Hang on.
But
do not want to see that cam.
No, you don't. I said what I wasn't thinking when I spoke. I apologize.
We'll blame it on the alcohol.
Yeah. I've been drinking. Go ahead, Swaff. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's pretty much it. It's just, like, this is probably... Okay, this is what's in the public domain right now. If that's the case, I can pretty much guarantee you that this is being used by the military as we speak. Hey, the military is generally about 40 years ahead in technology.
I'm not disputing it. I just think it's funny.
So we have to get anti-cockroach defenses.
So
that's a lot harder to put in a firewall against
if you,
those.
If you stomp on one of these things, can you be charged with destroying government property? I mean,
hey, you get charged with destroying government property if you take the GPS tracker off your car.
Oh.
Stop saying sad.
It doesn't belong to you.
If it doesn't belong to me, don't attach it to my property. Anyways, let's go on to this Wired article here. A new brain-computer interface allows a person to walk using a pair of mechanical leg braces controlled by brain signals. And they've actually got a video for this one, too. The guy's walking on a treadmill. As reported on RxiV, A-R-X-I-V. I don't know how to actually say that. And that's not just because I'm American. Arviz? I don't know. I'm going to hurt my tongue. The device has only been tested on able-bodied people, and while it has its limitation, it lays the that's so they can run away if the thing tries to kill them. It lays the foundation for helping people with paralysis walk again. It's an important step towards helping people with lower limb paralysis, said bionic engineer Matt Pfeiffer of Johns Hopkins University, who has done similar work but was not involved with the study. There are a lot of challenges, but there are a lot of challenges still, he said. The new device, developed by researchers at Long Beach Veterans Affairs Medical Center in the University of California, Irvine, is controlled by, electroencephalogram. Anybody else want to take
it? Electroencephalogram.
Thank you, Hugo. It's an EEG. Nobody calls it that, so we all call it an EEG because that word's hard to say. What the? Suave's playing Sega.
Sorry about that. Thought I had the sound turned off.
Signals generated by small voltage fluctuations in. We're talking about an EEG, and I'm totally lost here. Okay,
a Sega burned EEG.
There you go. Controlling Sonic the Hedgehog with a fucking EEG. The method is completely non-invasive, as the signals are measured by a cap worn on the scalp. The test subjects in the study wore such a cap while standing on a treadmill inside the leg braces known as robotic gait orthosis. Jeez. The subject would imagine walking or standing, and the device was taught to associate each brain activity pattern with the appropriate action. Then, whenever those patterns were encountered, the braces would start or stop walking accordingly. The researchers, who also measured leg muscle activity by EMG for three conditions, active walking with the robotic braces powered off, cooperative walking aided by the braces, and passive walking with the leg braces making all the movements. Despite a couple of false alarms when the machine began walking when it wasn't supposed to. Run away! It's tasted human blood!
Well, that's the big fear about all of these big exoskeletons and stuff like that. If it ever misbehaves... Let's say it decides your knee can bend in a way that it can't actually bend.
Crack.
Yeah.
Simpler method. It decides you want to keep walking into a busy street.
It's like, guess what? You're taking, or until somebody hacks your freaking legs, you're taking a long walk off a short roof. I mean, it's just, anyways, here we go. Despite a couple of false alarms where the machines began walking when it wasn't supposed to, the movement predictions were about 95% accurate. When the subject walked using the braces under brain control, the muscle activity appeared distinct from natural leg movement but similar to passive walking, suggesting no leg muscle control was necessary for robo-assisted walking. Previous work has shown that EEG signals can be used to control a computer, cursor, or drive a wheelchair. The new device adds to a growing body of research aimed at restoring mobility after spinal cord injury or nervous system disease. Of course, robotic legs still need to be tested by people with paralysis, and the brain control can only toggle between walking or not walking. Those are your options. Walking, not walking. Whereas the true walking aid would be, need to be able to engage changes in direction and speed. Oh, you can't steer! Oh, God! But it's, yeah, so I'm including the story because it's one step closer to the prosthetic body, you know, Ghost in the Shell prosthetic bodies here. But I am enjoying this. It's like, it's 95, you know, it occasionally makes mistakes. You can't steer and you can't control how fast you're going.
I just see somebody running into a wall.
While screaming, it won't stop! It won't stop! You know, thud.
Yeah.
Oh, hell.
And the worst part is they're paralyzed, so they can't do anything about it either.
Yeah. That's why they're only testing with able-bodied people. I'm sorry, that's not right. I shouldn't be laughing at this. This is awesome. I love the fact that they're using EEG to control robots and that they're starting to develop this stuff. It's just, this article is so sensationalist and so written in such a way. I mean, it's just funny. Because it's just, Hugo's right. The first thing I imagined was some dude who couldn't work his legs walking headfirst in a wall or off a roof or something, or out a window.
Mm-hmm. But so, again, it's one step closer to power armor.
That is absolutely the case, and that's why we're talking about it. So, anyways, let's see here. Oh, RU sent me a response. Not like you're going to break their back again. Okay. It's not like you're going to break their back again. Yes, absolutely.
Well,
are you?
They can break other things.
But you can also break your back in multiple locations.
Yeah, you can go from legs paralyzed to arms paralyzed to lungs paralyzed. That sounds like fun.
There you go. So anyways,
it depends where you get broken.
Next story here. This one's from Parody News. And what could be deemed as the fifth biggest heist of virtual currency... I wonder what the first four are. an attacker.
Well, we don't talk about those.
Yeah.
There was a huge heist in EVE Online for like hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Oh, that's right.
EVE
that was
Online
the guy
money.
Who scammed like so many people out of their money.
He basically started a bank.
And then just ran with the money.
Yeah.
Well, he called hell. He said the hell with it and just like gave the money away and then logged out of the game or something. Anyways, wow, we're getting rabbit holed. Anyways, in what could be deemed as the fifth biggest heist of virtual currency, an attacker managed to access an unencrypted backup of wallet key. Why would you have an unencrypted backup of financials? Of wallet keys and stole 24,000 Bitcoin equaling. I'm sorry, I'm having trouble with the way some of these people are writing. Equaling more than a quarter of a million U.S. dollars. Following this, Bitcoin exchange Bitfloor has been shut down while the investigation of theft is going on. The attack was carried out sometime last night, and this post is a couple days old, because of which Roman Scheitelman? Founder of Bitfloor suspended operations of the exchange. While we are writing this, the exchange rate of one Bitcoin is $10.40 in the U.S. Now, I checked it earlier today. It was up to $10.97.
That's actually kind of funny because, you know, that means that this big giant theft hasn't actually negatively impacted the value of Bitcoins.
Yeah. Taking the total value of the heist to $250,800 U.S. You can check current rates through Preve. In a forum post, Shuttleman has urged Bitcoin users that used Bitfloor needs their help. Okay. Bitfloor needs their help. In the forum post, the founder gives us a little detail about the attack while refraining from extensive detailing. Last night, a few of our servers were compromised. As a result, the attackers gained access to an unencrypted backup of the wallet keys. The actual keys live in an I cannot read tonight. The actual keys live in an encrypted area. Using these keys, they were able to transfer the coins. The attack took the vast majority of the coins Bitfloor was holding on hand, writes Roman. Shadowman has revealed that during the attack, none of the records were lost, and hence Bitfloor is aware of the amount each user had in their accounts. I still have logs for all the accounts, trades, and transfers, he wrote. I know exactly how much each user currently has left in their account for both US dollars and bitcoins. The Bitfloor founder is trying to find a way forward and ask users to suggest any ideas for Bitfloor operations. I would like to keep this thread focused on evaluating the ideas for Bitfloor operations, he writes. So yeah, and yeah, I just put a note in there that it was up to 1097.
Yeah, and I can think of a good suggestion for him. Encrypt your fucking backups.
Oh yeah. Well, it's like a bank leaving their vault and front door open at night when they close up for the evening.
Yeah, like, I mean, that's just silly to have. If you're going to have unencrypted backups, keep them in an offline system. That's why banks still use tape.
Yeah.
Because I tell you what, it's really fucking hard to hack into a tape if the tape's not in the drive.
And if it is, it still takes you forever to download the data.
That's true. But I mean, think about it. Wow, Suave, we're getting some hardcore like line noise off you or something, man.
Oh, are you?
Yeah, it almost sounds like a ground loop. Anyways, so yeah, Bitfloor got hacked. Bitcoins, you know, these exchanges, I kind of wonder about. Maybe you're better off like keeping. Maybe you need to set up a couple of Bitcoin accounts, and if you're going to use one of these exchanges, only put what you need when you do the transaction into it. I mean, people do the same thing with credit cards and bank accounts all the time, just in case an account gets popped. So I think you need to start treating Bitcoin the same way. If you're serious about Bitcoin, you probably want to set up two or three accounts and make sure you have an account that doesn't live anywhere but on your own personal system so that you can think of some exotic storage system that you can take offline, whether it's a USB hard drive that you unplug when you're not using it. Or if you want to get really fancy, I recommend building an XM4041 cable or an XM1541 cable and storing things on a Commodore 64 floppy disk. You might want to use two or three of them. But, you know, just for redundancy's sake, that way, even if somebody does get in your system, they don't have a fucking clue of how to get at that shit because they don't know what it is.
So everybody check for Bitcoins on Commodore systems at MIPS. Got it.
I keep my fucking financials on a Commodore 64. Specifically one that I haven't rigged to get on the internet. I want to see somebody hack that without physically touching it. Seriously. Good luck.
I'm the boss of the old Tempest readers.
No, that's what the remote control cockroaches are for.
Got a point.
Very nice. Very
Why
nice.
Why do it high tech when you can literally just sit a guy across the street with a pair of binoculars?
That's true. I'm going to have so many people trying to get into my network now. It's like, I'm looking for the Commodore.
Just get Mark really, really drunk. Hey, can you give me your, like, network password?
Yeah, sure, why not? It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 6. They never guessed that shit. Anyways. Okay, I'm kidding. Nobody use 1, 2, 3, 4, 6 as a password, please.
As they show up in your logs all night.
Yeah. That'll be the case, wouldn't it? Anyways, next story up. This is actually a Kickstarter project. I love the Tensi 2.0 boards. I've got like 6 of them floating around here. In fact, anybody at the meetup, when you saw the NES controller I had hacked up, it had a Tensi inside of it. That's how I was making the thing work. So this Kickstarter project, which is, by the way, way past their goal by like orders of magnitude, Tensi 3.0 is a small breadboard-friendly development board designed by Paul Strofingen and PJRC. Tensi 3.0 will bring a low-cost 32-bit ARM Cortex M4 platform to hobbyists, students, and engineers using Arduino or programming directly in C. So he's making an Arduino-compatible board that has a 32-bit ARM chip instead of an AVR. So let me scroll down in here a bit to where he starts talking about the features. Tensi 3.0 is about bringing much more capability to the Arduino environment at an easily affordable price. It is a tiny size and works great on breadboards and embedded in size projects. Numerous 32-bit ARM boards have appeared on the market over the last year, but most are quite difficult to use and only work with very expensive or crippled demo software. Tensiduino will support Tensi 3.0 on Arduino, running on Windows, Mac, or Linux, with the same ease of use as Tensi 2.0 and official Arduino products. A 32-bit processor and more memory are only the beginning. The chip is 16, has a 16-bit AD converter. So in other words, the thing can do freaking signal processing. And it's got an I2S interface, which can be used. So you can use it as a sound card, essentially. 10 pulse pins for interval timers and for delay timers that don't conflict with the pins. And apparently that's going to fix some problems people are having with Arduino libraries. And it can also be, I'm just skipping the description here, it can be USB host. So you could plug other USB devices into it and have your Arduino sketch actually access like a USB Wi-Fi card or something. So it's a Kickstarter. He's going to start production later this month. And of course, I've already put in my $30 to get mine. But I guess nobody else on this call really follows the Tensi stuff, so...
No, I don't really have an application for it at this point. Like, I like the idea, and, you know, I fully support it, but I have no projects that require it.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's not like a Raspberry Pi, right? Because it's not an ARM board with, like, a video out or anything like that. It's an Arduino.
Like it's not a PC or anything. It's for developing hardware, essentially.
Yeah, Suave, you might want to turn off your Sega Genesis there. You're getting some kind of horrid feedback on it. So, let's see here.
But the Sega Genesis is the only Ethernet-capable computer he has.
Nice. All right, this next one up. Of course, this has been the big story. On September 4th, 2012, Anonymous released... a million unique device identifiers from Apple iOS devices together with their associated Apple Push Notification Service tokens, device type, and name. The release was announced in a Twitter post and on Pastebin. According to Anonymous, the release is only a subset of over 12 million entries found in a laptop belonging to FBI agent Christopher K. Stengel. The full dump in the original file, NCFTA iOS device Intel CSV, contains UDID, usernames, type of device, type of name of device, APNS token, zip codes, mobile phone numbers, addresses, and more. Fortunately for now, the release made by Anonymous does not contain any personally identifiable information except for the name of the device, and they describe the purpose of the release as to create awareness among the public by the fact that the FBI might be monitoring, you know, iPhone usage. And of course, the FBI has put out a response saying the FBI is aware of published reports alleging an FBI laptop was compromised and that private data regarding Apple UDIDs was exposed. At this time, there is no evidence indicating that an FBI laptop was compromised or that FBI either sought or obtained this data. So yeah, the FBI is basically saying, nope, not us. So yeah. So let's see here. Anonymous, or at least people claiming to be anonymous, has lied before. And the FBI has lied before. So I don't actually know what's going on.
Well, I do know one thing. If you're going to use Apple devices, buy used. That way, when they when it leaks the information, it doesn't come back to you.
Very nice. Very nice. So, actually, hey, Suave. RU says that it's speaker feedback, like you're getting echoes somewhere. So I don't know. We'll mess with that later. So he says he has no speakers on. So yeah, because we made fun of him, he's not going to talk now. So that's okay. We've only got just a little bit left here to cover. So yeah, just if you're using iOS stuff, be aware the UUID might be out there. I don't know. I kind of took a skim through the Anonymous thing. There are a lot of John's iPhones in there, which I find amusing. So, like a lot of people name their device John's iPhone. So,
It automatically names that. It takes your name that you put in a registration info, and it automatically names your device that if you don't give it a name.
Ah, well, that explains it. So, and John would be a very, very common name. So, anyways, so let's go ahead and do this.
Me love you long time.
All right, I want to talk about this tool. I'm not even sure how to say it. Kautilya. K-A-U-T-I-L.
Kautilya?
Kautilya? Yeah, that could be it. I'm American. I don't know how to say funny words. I'm sorry. Kautilya is a toolkit which provides various payloads for Tinsy devices, which may be helpful in breaking into a computer. The toolkit is written in Ruby. The Windows payloads and modules are written in mostly in PowerShell, and a combination of native commands and are tested on Windows 7. The Linux payloads are mostly shell scripts, those installed by default, in combination with commands, and they are tested on Ubuntu 11. OS X payloads are shell scripts, and the tested on OS X Lion, running in VMware. I wonder if that means he was hackintoshing in VMware to get it to run.
Nope. Lion, now Apple's changed their licensing agreements. You can run Lion in a virtual machine if you are running Lion on the main system.
Ah, okay, cool. Anyways, he talks about getting on there, but essentially, I was talking about the Tinsy earlier with the news story. The Tinsy is an Arduino compatible board with a programmable USB UART. Essentially, you can make it show up on a computer like another device. I like using them for making controllers because you can make them show up as like a MIDI interface, a keyboard, a mouse, as a keyboard and a mouse, as a joystick, as a USB HID. And so they're really cool little dev boards, and they're cheap. They're like $16 a piece, and I've got several of them floating around here. And what this script does is this script generates a program for the Tinsy, which you can then copy into the Arduino environment and upload to the board. And when you upload it and then plug that Tinsy into a computer, it'll show up as a keyboard and start hammering out, as though somebody was typing really fast, the payload. Now, this is fun, because tell me, I'm not aware of a computer that, say, turns off auto run on a keyboard, or will not work if you plug a USB keyboard into it because it's not an approved device. I've never seen a machine that gets that anal about what you can plug into it. I've certainly seen people turn off USB drives, but how do you tell it not to use a USB keyboard? Because you kind of need one of those on a machine.
That's literally like those movies where someone hacks into a machine by plugging something in and letting it run.
Yeah, pretty much.
This is a crack stick.
Yeah, this is a crack stick, and I can tell you from personal experience, not only does it work, it's great fun. Anyway,
you could also embed this with a USB hub and some USB drives that would like automatically be detected by a computer, right?
Yeah.
And then you could have it download information to the drives for you.
You could. The problem with that is what this thing is actually doing is when you plug it in, it shows up to the computer as a USB keyboard and then hammers out a quick series of commands to like start run CMD, or actually I think PowerShell, and then it starts hammering out the PowerShell script to execute this and run these things. So generally a PowerShell script is not going to know offhand what USB drive letter a particular flash drive is going to get when you plug it in.
Yeah, but if you knew a little bit about the computer, or it was just like an off-the-shelf computer, an off-the-shelf computer will typically have like the C drive will be their hard drive, and their D drive will be their optical drive, and they might have another drive if it's one of those computers with the recovery partition.
Sure.
Other than that, like an off-the-shelf computer shouldn't have anything else.
Okay. Again, I'm just speaking from personal experience here. I've seen flash drives end up with so many different drive letters, like getting into G and F and E and. I mean, I've even seen them get up to J and I on some machines. So, and sometimes you even have to go into Device Manager and assign it a drive, a flash drive a letter because some partition's taking the one the drive wants. So it's not exactly predictable, at least in a general sense. I mean, if you know your target, you might be able to figure out where it's going to end up. But if it's got internet access, who fucking cares?
Because on Linux and Mac systems would be pretty easy because the fact that they would just a modern systems they would just mount in a specified directory under whatever the drive's named.
Sure. And actually on Linux you can use the UID and really be sure about it, even if it mounts in some funny folder. But on Windows at least you don't really know where it's gonna end up. That might not be entirely true. You might be able to do some trickery to locate drives, but that's a little bit beyond scope here. Especially if they have internet connection. So anyway, some of the more fun payloads on the Windows side, you can add an admin user. This is assuming you plug it in and it's whoever, you know, logged in is an admin already. It can edit the host's file. Can add a user and enable RDP, you know, remote desktop. It can add a keylogger and then upload what it's getting from the keylogger to Pastebin. It can tell Windows to turn on wireless guest access and give it a name that you would know what it is and create a user account for you. And you can have it download and execute something. So if you've got, say, a Metasploit box with an interpreter payload just sitting in a folder somewhere, you can have it pull down that payload and run it. And again, the idea is, you know, it generates a TINSI program, you upload it to the TINSI, and when you plug it into the computer, it just hammers out these commands. And suddenly your little $16 microcontroller, you can walk around and just stick a machine with it, count to 30, pull it out, and you've got a shell on that box, right? And I don't know about you guys, but how many like stores, when places in the mall you go in and you see like, you know, USB ports all over the place. They're cash registers or computers, and they don't have that little cover on the back, so you can see their USB ports. And they're probably running some Windows variant to do their cash register. So a lot of the scripts in the Katuya take advantage of Pastebin. There's actually one that will pull a PowerShell script down from Pastebin and run it. So if you have one of these TINSIs, this little set of scripts is absolute great fun. And the really nice thing is it doesn't just like upload it straight up. It generates a TINSI program, so you can still edit it. For example, my little NES controller, I uploaded 3 or 4 different ones and set it so that instead of just running whatever when you plugged it in, it would wait on me to hit a button on the controller and then run whichever one was tied to that button. So I could hit up to go pull down my interpreter shell. I could hit down to add a user. I could hit, you know, B to do the keylogger, and I forget what I uploaded to A. It's been a little while since I messed with this, and I've wiped it since then. But yeah, great fun, nice little script, and they added it to Backtrack in the last rev. So, you know, again, can you trust your hardware? Well, you don't. Not if you borrow a keyboard from me, because I might have slipped in one of these little things, and now I'm getting a shell on your box from your fucking keyboard.
So burn all hardware given to you by MIPS.
Absolutely. Don't let random people plug things into your computer, because even if it's not a flash drive, you don't know what it's going to do anymore.
So, well, I hope I won't let random people even into my house.
The worst is like, yeah, I know I sound like shit, but yeah, cell phones and stuff like that. Because, you know, people are like, oh, you got a free USB port? I need to charge my phone. You don't think about it. It's like, oh, well, it's just charging. Well, no, that's a data device, and it works just like a USB stick.
Actually, I've got a couple of old... That's an idea, Suave. I've got a couple of old phones kicking around here. I bet I could take one of those things apart, slip one of these things in it, and make a device that looks like a cell phone. It's like, oh, yeah, hey, can I plug my phone in and charge it? And it'll even light up when you plug it in. And, yeah, you know, I've got a shell in your box now.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, I love the cell phone idea. That's a great idea. So, you know, here you go.
Toasty!
So, anyways, just to kind of wrap things up here. Of course, always listen to the stream. We're constantly trying to update it. We're always looking for new music to add. And like I said earlier, we're actually looking for DJs. If you're interested in DJing on the internet, let us know. Because we can make that happen. Of course, Pure Decking every Thursday. Shoot the Noise on Wednesdays. NR7 on Mondays, or whenever somebody thinks to hit BSV with a cattle prod.
I know I forgot this week, but Labor Day interfered.
Yeah. I'm. Don't worry. I'm express mailing out at cattle prods to at least 3 of your close relatives. So, and of course, the Galaxy 15 radio site and the Twitter handles. Use the feedback form. Obviously, it's the easiest way to get a hold of us. We've got a shout box on there as well if you feel like, I guess, shouting at us. And I know I'm still working on the BBS. I haven't got there yet. I just work kicked my ass, so I haven't been able to work on stuff like I'd like. So has anybody else got anything before I play the music to close us out?
No.
Twisting, dancing, twisting.